Okay, well, I'd like to thank Laszlo for the honour of being invited to be keynote at this. I'd like to thank the whole audience for being here. I'm looking forward to a great discussion with you. And I hope you're pleased that I'm sharing my Scottish weather with you. Now, I've always believed in distributive justice, and it's important that you should have some rain as well as us.
Okay. Here you are.
But it has been very dry, so it's also necessary that we get the rain.
Okay, right. Now, well, I live in Glasgow. I teach in Edinburgh, but I live in Glasgow, so it's always wet in Glasgow. Edinburgh's dry, Glasgow's wet, it's on the west. Anyway, it's an amazing setup you've got here. You know, I just can't believe it's not completely dominated by a university. It's quite nice that it's separate. It's more like a little research, you know, center, and it's just away from the power politics of, and we were talking yesterday at dinner of the territorialism and tribalism of academia, because we're all doing interdisciplinary work, aren't we? Interdisciplinary research, innovative research at the margins, and you need to be free from the walls of academia. You know, it's not just Trump who believes in walls, every academic administrator does, in my experience. Look, I'm going to give an old-fashioned talk. You know, I usually use slides, of course, and PowerPoint, and I even started lecturing without any notes and any slides. That was 2 years ago, and that felt really cool, going into a lecture theatre with no notes. I mean, they were hidden in there, but I never used them, and it felt so cool lecturing without notes, living dangerously. But when I'm giving a formal presentation, I want to get the wording exactly right. Okay, so if you don't mind, I'm going to sometimes be reading my notes. I know it doesn't play so well on that panopticon device you've got there, the video, it's another story. Now, you said I wanted to talk about the big thinkers of the information age, and I did entitle it, Architects of the Information Age. And I was going to talk about two German guys. I know you all talk German around here. The Austrian-American Fritz Matchlup, who was an economist, very distinguished, and the Israeli-American Mark Yuri Porat, who also wrote an important work on information economy. But the third guy I was going to talk about is Daniel Bell. Daniel Bell. And, you know, as I started researching this, you didn't give me a lot of notice. You didn't approach me until the end of July, which isn't much of a lead-in, since I was wanting lots of sun in August in Spain. No work at all. And then we had to start the new term in September. So I haven't had that long to prepare this. As I started rereading all these guys' work, Matchlup, Porat, and Bell, all their work, which I haven't read for 25 years. And then, you know, quite quickly, it was only Bell I was interested in. Only Bell. And I really want to talk just about Bell today, because he is numero uno. And I want to convince you that you must go back to Bell if you want to understand human 2.0, 10.0, whatever it is. And you know, a lot of people say it's Castells now. I don't know if you've heard of him, Manuel Castells. He's the great intellect of the information age now. He is not. You heard it here, folks. You heard it from me. Daniel Bell is still the number one thinker of the information society. So, Bell, it's topical to talk about Bell today, because Bell was born 100 years ago, in 1919. And he died fairly recently, in 2011, at the ripe old age of 91. It was with Bell that a major synthesis was achieved, incorporating not just the economics of Matchlup, Porat, and other economists, but also sociology, philosophy, and dare I say it, futurology. Bell was a true polymath, one of the great thinkers of our time. Two of his books, The End of Ideology, published in 1960, and The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, published in 1978, were cited by the Times Literary Supplement as among the 100 most influential works written since the Second World War. In fact, his most influential book was undoubtedly The Coming of Post-Industrial Society, which, according to Google Scholar, a great authority, of course, has been cited over 22,000 times, compared with 5,000 for End of Ideology and 6,000 for Cultural Contradictions. It is this book and some associated papers that put flesh on the bones of matchlups and poorads, drive economic statistics, turning them into a grand social theory. Coming, as I may well refer to it as, tends nowadays to be eclipsed by Manuel Castells's The Information Age, but it is still the best guide for the perplexed, this quote from Maimonides, as I intend to show. Now, Bell was a journalist for 20 years before he became a professor, and that experience in the craft of writing makes his work extremely readable. He amusingly said he had four good reasons for leaving journalism for academia, June, July, August, and September. He was, not that we enjoy these holidays in Scotland. Bell was a master of paradox. He said he studied ancient history as an undergraduate because he wanted to understand modernity. He was asked when he signed up for graduate work, by the way, do we have any graduate students here? No, you're all professors. How intimidating. okay, no graduate students here. Oh, great. What are the rest of you then? Are you all academics and fellows? Are there undergraduates here? Wow, okay. I'll find out later. He was then asked when he signed up for graduate work, what was his specialism? And he famously replied, "I specialise in generalisations." He later came out with a brilliant slogan: "The nation-state is too small for the big problems and too big for the small problems." A good argument against Brexit, one might argue. His best line, though, for me, was when questioned about his political position. He said, "In all seriousness, I'm a socialist in economics, a liberal in politics, and a conservative in culture." According to one of his numerous critics, Bell's thought is never really at home in one particular ideological or political current. He crosses multiple positions with a counterintuitive heterodoxy that annoyed almost everyone. Actually, that trichotomy is the master key to Bell's work. Bell defined an intellectual as someone who makes relevant distinctions. He divides society into three realms, as he called them: the techno-economic system, the political order, and the cultural sphere. He insisted, against much sociology, that these aren't necessarily integrated. Nor does the techno-economic system determine the polity and culture, as in Marx's base superstructure model. On the contrary, they are governed by different principles, what he calls axial principles, and they can therefore be in conflict. It is with the techno-economic system that the coming of post-industrial society was primarily concerned. However, Bell had important things to say about politics and culture, and I will come on to these in due course. But let's start with the techno-economic system, or with the social structure, as he often calls it. Am I allowed a bit of water? Because I had a lot of coffee at breakfast. provided, why not have some?
It's always busy water here, isn't it?
Okay, so let's start with the techno-economic system. How much of what Bell wrote about post-industrialism is still useful? So look, guys, I'm reappraising Daniel Bell. This is a great time to reassess his views because the book was predictive. Its subtitle was A Venture in Social Forecasting. And according to the preface, it was forecasting where the United States would be 30 to 50 years on. Since the book was published, I know you've been waiting for this, in 1973, that takes us to between 2003 and 2023. So now is the day of reckoning. Bell was extremely knowledgeable about, as well as proud of his Jewish heritage. And by the way, down with neo-fascism in Eastern Europe. Okay, thought I'd put that in there. So he will have known that the punishment for false prophets was death by stoning. That cannot happen because Bell died in 2011 at the ripe old age, as I've said, 91. But in any case, he got most things right, so he need not have worried. The main argument in coming is that America and other advanced economies were moving out of the industrial era into a post-industrial era, a shift comparable to the Industrial Revolution, which turned agrarian economies into industrial ones. The most visible feature of post-industrial society is the move from blue-collar work to white-collar work. Whereas the industrial economy was dominated by the manufacturing of goods, services have become the main sector in the United States. In agrarian society, most people work on the land. In Ethiopia, I was looking it up the other night, 75% of people still work on the land. In agrarian societies, most people work on the land. In industrial societies, in factories. In post-industrial societies, in service occupations, particularly professional, technical, and managerial services. As Bell beautifully put it, pre-industrial society is a game against nature. Industrial society is a game against fabricated nature. And post-industrial society is a game between persons. Here, Bell is clearly correct. In the foreword to the 1999 reissue of Coming, Bell used my adopted home of Glasgow, anyone here from Glasgow? No, I didn't think so, as an illustration. Once the manufacturing and shipbuilding powerhouse of the British Empire, Glasgow has been transformed into a post-industrial centre of retail, tourism, and professional services. Of course, many people in services now don't wear any colour, blue or white, but you get my point. Now, Bell was from the start criticised for allegedly devaluing manufacturing industry. But it's essential to grasp that he wasn't claiming that post-industrial development wholly displaced the pre-industrial and industrial worlds, but rather saying that they operate on top of those worlds, like slides on top of one another, thickening thereby the texture of the social structure. What the new techno-economic mode brought was new principles of innovation. I believe, Zoltan, you're an expert on innovation. New modes of social organization and new classes in society. So the charge is false. However, it is true that his work, or at least the catchphrase post-industrialism, was sometimes deliberately misinterpreted and used to justify right-wing policies such as factory closures and outsourcing of jobs to developing countries. In the United Kingdom, Margaret Thatcher was very guilty of that. The switch from goods to services was not the key difference anyway.
key difference about post-industrial society, which is rather the change in the nature of knowledge and its relationship to production and policy. According to Bell, 19th century industries arose out of trial and error. They were the work of talented tinkerers, as he beautifully put it, rather than scientists. For example, Alexander Graham Bell, no relation, I don't think, was a scientific illiterate, but that didn't stop him inventing the telephone. However, modern industries are for the most part based on science and its deliberate application to technology. We see this in the application, for example, of physics and polymers and optics, or biology in the DNA-based industries. So research and development are now the handmaidens of innovation. Right? Goldman's nodding, so I must be getting something right. This was for Bell the essence of post-industrial society. Now, I've got a longer quote, which I know you're not meant to do, but I'm going to. The ganglion. Now, you won't know that word. Your English is amazing, much better than my Hungarian, right? but you won't know this word. Ganglion means nerve center, right? But I prefer ganglion, right? The ganglion. This is Bell, I'm quoting Bell, of the post-industrial society is knowledge. But to put it this way is banal. Knowledge is at the basis of every society. But in the post-industrial society, what is crucial is not just a shift from property or political position to knowledge as the new base of power, but a change in the character of knowledge itself. What has become decisive now for society is the new centrality of theoretical knowledge, the primacy of theory over empiricism, and the codification of knowledge into abstract systems of symbols that can be translated into many different and varied circumstances. So, knowledge is at the center of Bell's whole scheme. And his publishers picked this up by putting the slogan, "Knowledge Rules OK," on the front page of the first edition of The Coming of Post-Industrial Society. Knowledge is embedded in what Bell calls intellectual technology, another defining feature of post-industrial society. See, whereas machine technology of the industrial era extended human physical capacities, as in steam power, intellectual technology extends our mental faculties. This is where we go into human 2, 3, 4, 5, and AI, and expert systems. And it does this through algorithms, essentially, through replacing intuition with logical formulae. Now, I hardly need to defend Bell on the influence of algorithms in today's world. I also think Bell was right to identify intellectual technology rather than computers as the important development, although he had plenty to say about computers, especially in later texts, such as his influential article of 1979, The Social Framework of the Information Society, which for me remains the best ever article written on this whole domain. It's the one that got me interested for a whole career in the information society, The Social Framework of the Information Society, by Daniel Bell. Bell also drew attention, I'm describing post-industrial society, to the expansion of higher education, which had progressed from being a prerogative of the elite and become a mass system. He pointed out that college education had gone from 12% of 18 to 20-year-olds in 1935 in the United States, to 40% in 1970. It is now about 50% in both the United States and the United Kingdom. In South Korea, 80% of young people go to university. What is it in Hungary?
Fantastic.
Is it low?
What's that? Was it better?
It's getting better, is it? What?
Hopefully.
Okay, we've got a revolution to make. Let's start here today, right? Let's get it up to 40%. Okay, which I think is a reasonable number. What this meant, said Val, was that a new class structure was coming into being. Instead of being based on ownership of land or the means of production, wealth and power are increasingly based on education and qualifications. This, for Bell, was a positive change, just as the move from back-breaking industrial jobs in smokestack factories to service jobs was in the main an advance. All of this is pretty uncontroversial now in general terms, but Bell also made the much more debatable claim that an elite of the knowledge class would come to power and dominate society and policy. As he wrote in 1967 in another important paper entitled Notes on Post-Industrial Society, I'm going to give another long quote, go see what you want. To speak rashly, if the dominant figures of the past 100 years have been the entrepreneur, the businessman, and the industrial executive, the new men are the scientists, the mathematicians, the economists, and the engineers of the new computer technology, and the dominant institutions of the new society, in the sense that they will provide the most creative challenges and enlist the richest talents, will be the intellectual institutions. The leadership of the new society will rest not with the businessmen or corporations as we know them, but with the research corporation, the industrial laboratories, the experimental stations and the universities. In fact, he enthused, the skeletal structure of the new society is already visible. Bell, 1967. Now, what should we make of this? It looks, of course, now very much like an idealistic 1960s perspective. At bottom, put it cruelly, a view of the world from the campus of Harvard University, Massachusetts, where Bell was professor. Eventually the social sciences. Economic events, as we know, soon took a downward turn and paved the way for a resurgent, rampant capitalism glorified in the free market ideology of Friedman, Hayek and Nozick. However, although Bell failed to foresee neoliberalism and the glorification of the corporation, he was right, I believe, at a normative level. His ideal of a knowledge society, a society where experts are respected and decisions are based on evidence, is far preferable to most other types of society. It remains a goal we should work towards. We have an information explosion, yeah, and an information society, but there has been no knowledge explosion. And we desperately still need a knowledge society. It's essential to make this distinction. As Bell explained in his article, Gutenberg and the Computer, information is news, facts, statistics, reports, legislation, tax codes, judicial decisions, resolutions, and the like. Knowledge, on the other hand, is interpretation in context, exegesis, relatedness, a conceptualization. Knowledge is the effort to establish relevant relationships or connections between facts, data, and other information in some coherent form. Bell illustrates this distinction with the ancient Babylonians. They kept astronomical records for 1,000 years, but they never organized all that information into a theory of earthly or solar orbital movement. If Bell's only legacy were making this vital distinction, one for which for all his merits, Manuel Castells and his followers failed to make, that would be a great service. Okay, I'm 2/3 of the way through, still asleep, awake. So much about sociology. Let's move on now. I'm going to speak about the other two realms more briefly. Let's move on now to his politics. Here things get very tricky.
I'm not sure if you guys are going to agree with me, having suffered communism in the near past. But anyway, as I've already said, he called himself a socialist, but he was accused by his critics, particularly by Marxists, of being a neoconservative. In fact, he was neither socialist nor neocon, but rather a centrist, a proverbial woolly liberal. It's very relevant to examine Bell's political philosophy because I think its failings show the direction in which society needs to go. If the essential meaning and promise of information technology is to be kept, and I take it that the essential promise and meaning of information technology is some form of digital socialism, but nothing like what people suffered under communism. When explaining what he meant by socialist and economics, Bell tended to list mild forms of state provision for the disadvantaged. For example, in an interview for Arguing the World, a wonderful documentary about him and other members of the small group known as the New York Intellectuals, Bell said, "I'm a socialist in economics because I believe that every society has an obligation to give people that degree of decency to allow them to feel that they are citizens in this society. In the realm of economics, the first tie on resources should be that of the community in a redistributive way." So Bell clearly supports a welfare state, the guarantee of a minimum standard of living to everyone. But that does not, I'm afraid, make him a socialist. Socialism, as I understand it, and I've written a book on it, demands a social maximum as well as a social minimum. It demands an upper limit on wealth and power. That's the difference between liberalism or centrism and socialism. Although Bell mentions in that quote redistribution, it becomes apparent elsewhere that Bell is not in favour of a politics of even mildly radical redistribution. An important source for Bell's political position is his book Marxian Socialism in the United States, sadly now out of print, although I ordered my second-hand copy from Amazon. In this very impressive history of parties of the left in America, essentially an extended response to Walter Sombart's question, why is there no socialism in the United States? Bell distances himself from all variants of Marxism. As he put it elsewhere, "I'm a post-Marxist. I think against Marx." But Bell is not only not a Marxist, he's not a democratic socialist or a social democrat either. This is made explicit in the lengthy final section of Coming, where Bell takes issue with the great John Rawls's magnum opus, A Theory of Justice, describing it as the most comprehensive effort in modern philosophy to justify a socialist ethic. Bell finds fault with Rawls's famous difference principle, according to which inequalities are permitted, but only if they maximize the position of the worst off. The maximin principle, mild though it is from a socialist point of view, is too strong for Bell, who offers instead his own theory of justice he calls the just meritocracy. The governing principle of just meritocracy is equal opportunities, people being level at the starting line of the economic race. Les carrières ouvertes aux talents, the careers open to the talented, as the French put it. And with Bell, it is of course particularly about enabling the professional and technical intelligentsia to get to the top. But the trouble with meritocracy is that it is harsh, generating unlimited inequalities and creating a sorry class of losers. That's precisely why Rawls said that equal opportunity needs to be supplemented by a principle that softens the end of the race. Bell declared that every society divides into elite and mass, but that begs the whole question of the possibility of a more equal, classless society. He vilifies that as populism, but it isn't populism, it's simply social democracy. So I think Bell's political philosophy was defective. He doesn't basically stress social justice enough. He never came out in favour of the victims of McCarthy, never strongly. He never came out in favour of the Jews as they suffered in Europe. He didn't put himself out. He wasn't radical enough. He wasn't passionate enough about social justice. And in this respect, Castells is superior with his evident concern for victims throughout the world, languishing in what he, Castells, calls the black holes of informational capitalism. Bell surely betrayed his own optimism about the coming of post-industrial society, setting for a dry technocracy when he should have been probing the possibilities of a genuinely new social and political paradigm. I put it to you that despite all that has happened since those heady days at the start of the information revolution, we should still be pursuing that new paradigm. Final section. I said that Bell split society into three parts, and I want to end with some very brief remarks about the third, what he calls the cultural realm. Defining this broadly as the sphere of meanings, beliefs, and worldviews, everything from art to religion, Bell takes culture very seriously. He repeatedly rejects the Marxist-Leninist view that culture is just the ideological foam that covers over exploitative economic relations. For Bell, it is an autonomous realm, often operating independently of and even in conflict with the economic system. And he finds such a conflict at the very heart of post-industrial society. Bell said that as a social scientist, he thought against Marx and with Weber. He thought Max Weber's essay, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, was the most important sociological work of the 20th century. Weber, of course, argued, as the title tells us, that the enormous success of industrial capitalism is due to the Protestant work ethic, the ethic of self-restraint and delayed gratification. Accepting this argument, Bell speculated that the breakdown of Protestant norms in the West spelled trouble. The modernist and even so postmodernist culture, with its enthronement of the imperial self and the spread of hedonistic values of instant gratification and excessive consumption, would ultimately undermine capitalism and the entire bourgeois order, leaving society in a state of terminal crisis. This is what he meant by the cultural contradictions of capitalism. Now, Bell was, I think, wrong about this. Economic growth does not depend on Protestantism or any other form of religion. We can see this very clearly now in the new engine of growth that is Silicon Valley. As I noted in my argument, Rating the Revolution, based on recent fieldwork in the Valley, there's very little spiritual consciousness out there, certainly very little organized religion, yet it's enormously efficient and prosperous. It has somehow managed to combine the sensibility of the 60s with the mercenary spirit and know-how of 19th century entrepreneurialism. So there's no immediate crisis. However, Bell was, I think, right about the wider danger to the information society from the overthrow of the past. This has led, he said, to a loss of anchorage and moral identity in the new modes of work and being. This is what I found when I went out to Silicon Valley. Enormousness, a lack of roots, a lack of community. In Silicon Valley, no one knows anyone else's mother. What can be done about this vacuum? Bell ends by calling for what he calls, I'm coming to land, guys. Bell ends by what he calls, calling for what he calls a rebirth of civitas, meaning by that the emotional and moral bond that nourishes private sacrifice for the common good. It means the spontaneous willingness to obey the law, to respect the rights of others, and to forego the temptations of private enrichment at the expense of the public good. In short, to honour the city of which one is a member. Indeed, Bell calls for, well aware that this is to risk an unfashionable answer, he calls for the return in Western society, you're going to hate me for this, of some conception of religion. Now, although not a believer himself, he believed in the need to retain a sacred space, that we need a society that is not wholly absorbed in the economic engorgement of the profane, and in a capitalism that treats nothing as sacred, a capitalism that converts all objects into commodities to be bought and sold to the highest bidders. It is this treating nothing as sacred, whether you're a believer or not, religion for Bell is about there being some things that are sacred. This libertarianism that treats nothing as sacred, it is this that threatens the liberal order and puts democracy, liberal democracy, at risk. As Bell writes in The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, if the sacred is destroyed, then we are left with the shambles of appetite and self-interest and the destruction of the moral circle that engirds mankind. It's a very different line from Castells, whose trilogy, The Information Age, is shot through with hostility towards and contempt for religion. Castells never really gets beyond information and information technology. Yes, the Washington Post was correct when it headlined its obituary of Bell in 2011, Sociologist Who Foresaw the Internet's Rise. But Bell, the seer, saw much more. He recognized that information is lower than knowledge and infinitely lower than wisdom, that universals are more important than particulars. So perhaps I can end with a quotation from T.S. Eliot, which Bell used at the top of his another marvellous article, Teletext and Technology, New Networks of Knowledge and Information in Post-Industrial Society. He quoted this at the top of that article in 1977. Now say this out, savour it, comrades, savour it. This is the greatest English poet of the 20th century. The endless cycle of idea and action, endless invention, endless experiment, brings knowledge of motion, but not of stillness. Where is the life we have lost in living? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? And where is the knowledge we have lost in information? If agreeing with that makes you a cultural conservative, then I'm afraid I'm a cultural conservative. I leave you, therefore, with this vision of a knowledge society, one based for sure on ever-expanding information technology and artificial intelligence and human whatever, but also anchored in the wisdom of the past. That vision can, and I believe should, help to shape all our discussions of humanity 2.0. Thank you.